Mostly, though, there is thankfully nothing to worry about, except for the fact that the use of the representativeness heuristic can cause people to confuse random fluctuations with causal patterns. Optimism and overconfidence. Before the start of Thaler's class in managerial decision-making, students fill out an anonymous survey on the course website. One of the questions is, in which decile do you expect to fall in the distribution of grades in this class? Students can check the top 10%, the second 10%, and so forth. Since these are MBA students, they are presumably well aware that in any distribution, half the population will be in the top 50% and half in the bottom, and only 10% of the class can, in fact, end up in the top decile. Nevertheless, the results of this survey reveal a high degree of unrealistic optimism about performance in the class. Typically, less than 5% of the class expects their performance to be below the median, the 50th percentile, and more than half the class expects to perform in one of the top two deciles. Invariably, the largest group of students put themselves in the second decile. We think this is most likely explained by modesty. They really think they will end up in the top decile, but are too modest to say so. MBA students are not the only ones overconfident about their abilities. The above-average effect is pervasive. 90% of all drivers think they are above average behind the wheel, even if they don't live in Lake Wobegon. And nearly everyone, including some who are rarely seen smiling, thinks he has an above-average sense of humor. That is because they know what is funny. This applies to professors, too. About 94% of professors at a large university were found to believe that they are better than the average professor, and there is every reason to think that such overconfidence applies to professors in general. Yes, we admit to this particular failing. People are unrealistically optimistic even when the stakes are high. About 50% of marriages end in divorce, and this is a statistic most people have heard. But around the time of the ceremony, almost all couples believe that there is approximately a 0% chance that their marriage will end in divorce, even those who have already been divorced. Second marriage, Samuel Johnson once quipped, is the triumph of hope over experience. A similar point applies to entrepreneurs starting new businesses, where the failure rate is at least 50%. In one survey of people starting new businesses, typically small businesses, such as contracting firms, restaurants, and salons, respondents were asked two questions. A. What do you think is the chance of success for a typical business like yours? B. What is your chance of success? The most common answers to these questions were 50% and 90% respectively, and many said 100% to the second question. Unrealistic optimism can explain a lot of individual risk-taking, especially in the domain of risks to life and health. Asked to envision their future, students typically say that they are far less likely than their classmates to be fired from a job, to have a heart attack, or get cancer, to be divorced after a few years of marriage, or to have a drinking problem. Gay men systematically underestimate the chance that they will contract AIDS, even though they know about AIDS risks in general. Older people underestimate the likelihood that they will be in a car accident or suffer major diseases. Smokers are aware of the statistical risks, and often even exaggerate them, but most believe that they are less likely to be diagnosed with lung cancer and heart disease than most non-smokers. Lotteries are successful partly because of unrealistic optimism. Unrealistic optimism is a pervasive feature of human life. It characterizes most people in most social categories. When they overestimate their personal immunity from harm, people may fail to take sensible preventive steps. If people are running risks because of unrealistic optimism, they might be able to benefit from a nudge. In fact, we have already mentioned one possibility. If people are reminded of a bad event, they may not continue to be so optimistic. Gains and losses. People hate losses, and their automatic systems can get pretty emotional about them. Roughly speaking, losing something makes you twice as miserable as gaining the same thing makes you happy. In more technical language, people are loss-averse. How do we know this? Consider a simple experiment. Half the students in a class are given coffee mugs with the insignia of their home university embossed on it. The students who do not get a mug are asked to examine their neighbor's mugs. Then mug owners are invited to sell their mugs and non-owners are invited to buy them. They do so by answering the question, at each of the following prices, indicate whether you would be willing to give up your mug, buy a mug. The results show that those with mugs demand roughly twice as much to give up their mugs as others are willing to pay to get one. Thousands of mugs have been used in dozens of replications of this experiment, but the results are nearly always the same. Once I have a mug, I don't want to give it up, but if I don't have one, I don't feel an urgent need to buy one. What this means is that people do not assign specific values to objects. When they have to give something up, they are hurt more than they are pleased if they acquire the very same thing. It is also possible to measure loss aversion with gambles. Suppose I ask you whether you want to make a bet. Heads, you win X dollars. Tails, you lose $100. How much does X have to be for you to take the bet? For most people, the answer to this question is somewhere around $200. This implies that the prospect of winning $200 just offsets the prospect of losing $100. Loss aversion helps produce inertia, meaning a strong desire to stick with your current holdings. If you are reluctant to give up what you have because you do not want to incur losses, then you will turn down trades you might have otherwise made. In another experiment, half the students in a class received coffee mugs, of course, and half got large chocolate bars. The mugs and the chocolate cost about the same, and in pretests, students were as likely to choose one as the other. Yet when offered the opportunity to switch from a mug to a candy bar or vice versa, only 1 in 10 switched. As we shall see, loss aversion operates as a kind of cognitive nudge, pressing us not to make changes, even when changes are very much in our interests. Status quo bias. Loss aversion is not the only reason for inertia. For lots of reasons, people have a more general tendency to stick with their current situation. This phenomenon, which William Samuelson and Richard Zuckhauser, 1988, have dubbed the status quo bias, has been demonstrated in numerous situations. Most teachers know that students tend to sit in the same seats in class, even without a seating chart, but status quo bias can occur even when the stakes are much larger, and it can get us into a lot of trouble. For example, in retirement savings plans, such as 401ks, most participants pick an asset allocation and then forget about it. In one study conducted in the late 1980s, participants in TIAA-CREF, the pension plan of many college professors, the median number of changes in the asset allocation of the lifetime of a professor was, believe it or not, zero. In other words, over the course of their careers, more than half of the participants made exactly no changes to the way their contributions were being allocated. Perhaps even more telling, many married participants who were single when they joined the plan still have their mothers listed as their beneficiaries. Status quo bias is easily exploited. Many years ago, American Express wrote Sunstein a cheerful letter telling him that he would receive, for free, 3 months' subscriptions to 5 magazines of his choice. Free subscriptions seem like a bargain, even if the magazines rarely get read, so Sunstein happily made his choices. What he didn't realize was that unless he took some action to cancel his subscription, he would continue to receive the magazines, paying for them at the normal rate. For about a decade, he has continued to subscribe to magazines that he hardly ever reads. He keeps intending to cancel those subscriptions, but somehow never gets around to it. We hope to get around to discussing procrastination in the next chapter. One of the causes of status quo bias is a lack of attention. Many people adopt what we call the "yeah, whatever" heuristic. A good illustration is the carryover effect in television viewing. Network executives spend a lot of time working on scheduling because they know that a viewer who starts the evening on NBC tends to stay there. Since remote controls have been pervasive in this country for decades, the actual switching costs in this context are literally one thumb press. But when one show ends and the next one comes on, a surprisingly high number of viewers implicitly say, "yeah, whatever," and keep watching. Nor is Sunstein the only victim of automatic renewal of magazine subscriptions. Those who are in charge of circulation know that when renewal is automatic, and when people have to make a phone call to cancel, the likelihood of renewal is much higher than it is when people have to indicate that they actually want to continue to receive the magazine. The combination of loss aversion with mindless choosing implies that if an option is designated as the default, it will attract a large market share. Default options thus act as powerful nudges. In many contexts, defaults have some extra nudging power because consumers may feel, rightly or wrongly, that default options come with an implicit endorsement from the default setter, be it the employer, government, or TV scheduler. For this and other reasons, setting the best possible defaults will be a theme we explore often in the course of this book. Framing. Suppose that you are suffering from serious heart disease and that your doctor proposes a grueling operation. You're understandably curious about the odds. The doctor says, of 100 patients who have this operation, 90 are alive after 5 years. What will you do? If we fill in the facts in a certain way, the doctor's statement will be pretty comforting, and you'll probably have the operation. But suppose the doctor frames his answer in a somewhat different way. Suppose he says, of 100 patients who have this operation, 10 are dead after 5 years. If you're like most people, the doctor's statement will sound pretty alarming, and you might not have the operation. The automatic system thinks, a significant number of people are dead, and I might be one of them. In numerous experiments, people react very differently to the information that 90 of 100 are alive than to the information that 10 of 100 are dead, even though the content of the two statements is exactly the same. Even experts are subject to framing effects. When doctors are told that 90 of 100 are alive, they are more likely to recommend the operation than if told that 10 of 100 are dead. Framing matters in many domains. When credit cards started to become popular forms of payment in the 1970s, some retail merchants wanted to charge different prices to their cash and credit card customers. Credit card companies typically charge retailers 1% of each sale. To prevent this, credit card companies adopted rules that forbade their retailers from charging different prices to cash and credit customers. However, when a bill was introduced in Congress to outlaw such rules, the credit card lobby turned its attention to language. Its preference was that if a company charged different prices to cash and credit customers, the credit price should be considered the normal, default price, and the cash price a discount, rather than the alternative of making the cash price the usual price and charging a surcharge to credit card customers. The credit card companies have a good intuitive understanding of what psychologists would come to call framing. The idea is that choices depend, in part, on the way in which problems are stated. The point matters a great deal for public policy. Energy conservation is now receiving a lot of attention, so consider the following information campaigns. A. If you use energy conservation methods, you will receive $350 per year. B. If you do not use energy conservation methods, you will lose $350 per year. It turns out that information campaign B, framed in terms of losses, is far more effective than information campaign A. If the government wants to encourage energy conservation, option B is the stronger nudge. Framing works because people tend to be somewhat mindless, passive decision makers. Their reflective system does not do the work that would be required to check and see whether reframing the questions would produce a different answer. One reason they don't do this is that they wouldn't know what to make of the contradiction. This implies that frames are powerful nudges and must be selected with caution. So what? Our goal in this chapter has been to offer a brief glimpse at human fallibility. The picture that emerges is one of busy people trying to cope in a complex world in which they cannot afford to think deeply about every choice they have to make. People adopt sensible rules of thumb that sometimes lead them astray. Because they are busy and have limited attention, they accept questions as posed rather than trying to determine whether their answers would vary under alternative formulations. The bottom line, from our point of view, is that people are, shall we say, nudgeable. Their choices, even in life's most important decisions, are influenced in ways that would not be anticipated in a standard economic framework. Here is one final example to illustrate. One of the most scenic urban thoroughfares in the world is Chicago's Lakeshore Drive, which hugs the Lake Michigan coastline that is the city's eastern boundary. The drive offers stunning views of Chicago's magnificent skyline. There is one stretch of this road that puts drivers through a series of S-curves. These curves are dangerous. Many drivers fail to take heed of the reduced speed limit, 25 miles per hour, and wipe out. Recently, the city has employed a new way of encouraging drivers to slow down. At the beginning of the dangerous curve, drivers encounter a sign painted on the road warning of the lower speed limit, and then a series of white stripes painted onto the road. The stripes do not provide much, if any, tactile information. They are not speed bumps, but rather just send a visual signal to drivers. When the stripes first appear, they are evenly spaced, but as drivers reach the most dangerous portion of the curve, the stripes get closer together, giving the sensation that driving speed is increasing. See figure 1.5. One's natural instinct is to slow down. When we drive on this familiar stretch of road, we find that those lines are speaking to us, gently urging us to touch the brake before the apex of the curve. We have been nudged. Chapter 2, Resisting Temptation. Temptation. Many years ago, Thaler was hosting dinner for some guests, other than young economists, and put out a large bowl of cashew nuts to nibble on with the first bottle of wine. Within a few minutes it became clear that the bowl of nuts was going to be consumed in its entirety, and that the guests might lack sufficient appetite to enjoy all the food that was to follow. Leaping into action, Thaler grabbed the bowl of nuts and, while sneaking a few more nuts for himself, removed the bowl to the kitchen, where it was put out of sight. When he returned, the guests thanked him for removing the nuts. The conversation immediately turned to the theoretical question of how they could possibly be happy about the fact that there was no longer a bowl of nuts in front of them. You can now see the wisdom of the rule of thumb mentioned in Chapter 1 about a cap on the proportion of economists among attendees at a dinner party. In economics, and in ordinary life, a basic principle is that you can never be made worse off by having more options, because you can always turn them down. Before Thaler removed the nuts, the group had the choice of whether to eat the nuts or not. Now they didn't. In the land of econs, it is against the law to be happy about this. To help us understand this example, consider how the preferences of the group seem to evolve over time. At 7:15, just before Thaler removed the nuts, the dinner guests had three options: eat a few nuts, eat all the nuts, and eat no more nuts. Their first choice would be to eat just a few more nuts, followed by eating no more nuts. The worst option was finishing the bowl, since that would ruin dinner. But by 7:30, had the nuts remained on the table, the group would have finished the bowl, thereby reaching their least favorite option. Why would the group change its mind in the space of just 15 minutes? Or do we really want to say that the group had changed its mind? In the language of economics, the group is said to display behavior that is dynamically inconsistent. Initially, people prefer A to B, but they later choose B over A. We can see dynamic inconsistency in many places. On Saturday morning, people might say that they prefer exercising to watching television, but once the afternoon comes, they are on the couch at home watching the football game. How can such behavior be understood? Two factors must be introduced in order to understand the cashew phenomenon: temptation and mindlessness. Human beings have been aware of the concept of temptation at least since the time of Adam and Eve, but for purposes of understanding the value of nudges, that concept needs elaboration. What does it mean for something to be tempting? As with Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart's "I know it when I see it" adage about pornography, temptation is easier to recognize than to define. Our preferred definition requires recognizing that people's state of arousal varies over time. To simplify things, we will consider just the two endpoints, hot and cold. When Sally is very hungry and appetizing aromas are emanating from the kitchen, we can say she is in a hot state. When Sally is thinking abstractly on Tuesday about the right number of cashews she should consume before dinner on Saturday, she is in a cold state. We will call something tempting if we consume more of it when hot than when cold. None of this means that decisions made in a cold state are always better. For example, sometimes we have to be in a hot state to overcome our fears about trying new things. Sometimes dessert really is delicious, and we do best to go for it. Sometimes it is best to fall in love. But it is clear that when we are in a hot state, we can often get into a lot of trouble. Most people realize that temptation exists, and they take steps to overcome it. The classic example was that of Ulysses, who faced the peril of the sirens and their irresistible songs. While in a cold state, Ulysses instructed his crew to fill their ears with wax so they would not be tempted by the music. He also asked the crew to tie him to the mast so that he could listen for himself, but be restrained from submitting to the temptation to steer the ship closer when the music put him into a hot state. Ulysses successfully solved his problem. For most of us, however, self-control issues arise because we underestimate the effect of arousal. This is something the behavioral economist George Lowenstein, 1996, calls the hot-cold empathy gap. When in a cold state, we do not appreciate how much our desires and our behavior will be altered when we are under the influence of arousal. As a result, our behavior reflects a certain naivety about the effects that context can have on choice. Tom is on a diet and agrees to go out on a business dinner, thinking that he will be able to limit himself to one glass of wine and no dessert. But the host orders a second bottle of wine and the waiter brings by the dessert cart and all bets are off. Marilyn thinks that she can go into a department store when they are having a big sale and just see whether they have something on sale that she really needs. She ends up with shoes that hurt, but were 70% off. Robert thinks he will engage only in safe sex, but then must make all the crucial decisions while aroused. Similar problems affect those who have problems with smoking, alcohol, a failure to exercise, excessive borrowing, and insufficient savings. Self-control problems can be illuminated by thinking about an individual as containing two semi-autonomous selves, a far-sighted planner and a myopic doer. You can think of the planner as speaking for your reflective system, or the Mr. Spock lurking within you, and the doer as heavily influenced by the automatic system, or everyone's Homer Simpson. The planner is trying to promote your long-term welfare but must cope with the feelings, mischief, and strong will of the doer, who is exposed to the temptations that come with arousal. Recent research in neuroeconomics, yes, there really is such a field, has found evidence consistent with this two-system conception of self-control. Some parts of the brain get tempted, and other parts are prepared to enable us to resist temptation by assessing how we should react to the temptation. Sometimes the two parts of the brain can be in severe conflict, a kind of battle that one or the other is bound to lose. Mindless choosing. The cashew problem is not only one of temptation. It also involves the type of mindless behavior we discussed in the context of inertia. In many situations, people put themselves into an automatic pilot mode in which they are not actively paying attention to the task at hand. The automatic system is very comfortable that way. On a Saturday morning when we set out to run an errand, we can easily find ourselves driving our usual route to work until we realize we are headed in the opposite direction from our intended destination, the grocery store. On a Sunday morning, we follow our ordinary routine with coffee and the newspaper until we realize that we had arranged to meet a friend for brunch an hour earlier. Eating turns out to be one of the most mindless activities we do. Many of us simply eat whatever is put in front of us. That is why even massive bowls of cashews are likely to be consumed completely, regardless of the quality of the food that is soon to be arriving. The same is true of popcorn, even stale popcorn. A few years ago, Brian Wansink and his colleagues ran an experiment in a Chicago movie theater in which moviegoers found themselves with a free bucket of stale popcorn. It had been popped 5 days earlier and stored so as to ensure that it would actually squeak when eaten. People were not specifically informed of its staleness, but they didn't like the popcorn. As one moviegoer said, it was like eating styrofoam packing peanuts. In the experiment, half of the moviegoers received a big bucket of popcorn and half received a medium-sized bucket. On average, recipients of the big bucket ate about 53% more popcorn, even though they didn't really like it. After the movie, Wansink asked the recipients of the big bucket whether they might have eaten more because of the size of their bucket. Most denied the possibility, saying, "Things like that don't trick me." But they were wrong. The same is true of soup. In another Wansink, 2006, masterpiece, people sat down to a large bowl of Campbell's tomato soup and were told to eat as much as they wanted. Unbeknownst to them, the soup bowls were designed to refill themselves, with empty bottoms connected to machinery beneath the table. No matter how much soup subjects ate, the bowl never emptied. Many people just kept eating, not paying attention to the fact that they were really eating a great deal of soup until the experiment was, mercifully, ended. Large plates and large packages mean more eating. They are a form of choice architecture, and they work as major nudges. Hint. If you would like to lose weight, get smaller plates, buy little packages of what you like, and don't keep tempting food in the refrigerator. When self-control problems and mindless choosing are combined, the result is a series of bad outcomes for real people. Millions of Americans still smoke in spite of the evidence that smoking has terrible health consequences, and, significantly, the overwhelming majority of smokers say that they would like to quit. Nearly two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese. Many people never get around to joining their company's retirement savings plan, even when it is heavily subsidized. Together, these facts suggest that significant numbers of people could benefit from a nudge. Self-control strategies. Since people are at least partly aware of their weaknesses, they take steps to engage outside help. We make lists to help us remember what to buy at the grocery store. We buy an alarm clock to help us get up in the morning. We ask friends to stop us from having dessert or to fortify our efforts to quit smoking. In these cases, our planners are taking steps to control the actions of our doers, often by trying to change the incentives that doers face. Unfortunately, doers are often difficult to rein in. Think of controlling Homer, and they can foil the best efforts of planners. Consider the mundane but revealing example of the alarm clock. The optimistic planner sets the alarm at 6:15 a.m., hoping for a full day of work, but the sleepy doer turns off the alarm and goes back to sleep until 9. This can lead to fierce battles between the planner and the doer. Some planners put the alarm clock on the other side of the room, so the doer at least has to get up to turn it off, but if the doer crawls back into bed, all is lost. Fortunately, enterprising firms sometimes offer to help the planner out. Consider the alarm clock, Clocky, pictured on Figure 2.1. Clocky is the alarm clock that runs away and hides if you don't get out of bed. With Clocky, the planner sets the number of snooze minutes the doer will be permitted in the morning. When the number runs out, the clock jumps off the nightstand and moves around the room making annoying sounds. The only way to turn the damn thing off is to get out of bed and find it. By that time, even a groggy doer is awake. Planners have a number of available strategies, such as Clocky, to control recalcitrant doers. But they can sometimes use some help from outsiders. We will be exploring how private and public institutions can provide that help. In daily life, one strategy involves informal bets. Thaler once helped a young colleague by using this strategy. The colleague, let's call him David, had been hired as a new faculty member with the expectation that he would complete the requirements for his PhD before he arrived, or at worst within his first year as a faculty member. David had lots of incentives to finish his thesis, including a strong financial incentive, until he graduated the university treated him as an instructor rather than as an assistant professor, and did not make its normal contributions to his retirement plan, which amounted to 10% of his salary, thousands of dollars a year. David's inner planner knew that he needed to stop procrastinating and get his thesis done, but his doer was involved in many other more exciting projects, and always put off the drudgery of writing up the thesis. Thinking about new ideas is usually more fun than writing up old ones. That is when Thaler intervened by offering David the following deal. David would write Thaler a series of checks for $100, payable on the first day of each of the next few months. Thaler would cash each check if David did not put a copy of a new chapter of the thesis under his door by midnight of the corresponding month. Furthermore, Thaler promised to use the money to have a party to which David would not be invited. David completed his thesis on schedule 4 months later, never having missed a deadline, though most chapters were completed within mere minutes of being due. It is instructive that this incentive scheme worked even though David's monetary incentive from the university was greater than $100 a month, just from the retirement contribution alone. The scheme worked because the pain of having Thaler cash the check and consume good wine without him was more salient than the rather abstract and pallid foregone contribution to his retirement savings plan. Many of Thaler's friends have threatened to go into business competing with him on this incentive plan, though Thaler points out that in order to go into this business, you have to be known as a big enough jerk actually to cash the check. Sometimes friends can adopt such betting strategies together. John Romalis and Dean Carlin, two economists, adopted an ingenious arrangement for weight loss. When John and Dean were in graduate school in economics, they noticed that they were putting on weight, especially during the period when they were on the job market and being wined and dined by potential employers. They each made a pact. Each agreed to lose 30 pounds over a period of 9 months. If either failed, he had to pay the other $10,000. The bet was a big success. Both met their target. They then turned to the more difficult problem of keeping the weight off. The rules they adopted were that on one day's notice, either one could call for a weigh-in. If either was found to be over the target weight, he would have to pay the other an agreed sum. In 4 years, there were several weigh-ins, and only once was either one over target. The resulting fine was paid in full immediately. Notice that as in the case of David's thesis bet, Dean and John were acknowledging that without the bet to encourage them, they would have eaten too much, even though they still would have wanted to lose the weight. More formal versions of these strategies are easy to imagine. In Chapter 16, we will encounter the website Stick.com, of which Carlin is a co-founder, which gives people a method by which their planners can constrain their doers. In some situations, people may even want the government to help them deal with their self-control problems. In extreme cases, governments might ban some items, such as heroin use, prostitution, and drunken driving. Such bans can be seen as pure rather than libertarian paternalism, though third-party interests are also at stake. In other cases, individuals may prefer a less intrusive role for the government. For example, smokers might benefit from cigarette taxes, which discourage consumption without forbidding it. Also, some states have attempted to help gamblers by creating a mechanism by which they can put themselves on a list of people who are banned from casinos. Again, see Chapter 16 for details. Since no one is required to sign up, and since a refusal to do so is close to costless, this approach really can be counted as libertarian as we understand the term. One interesting example of a government-imposed self-control strategy is daylight saving time, or summertime, as it is called in many parts of the world. Surveys reveal that most people think that daylight savings time is a great idea, primarily because they enjoy the extra hour of daylight during the evening. Of course, the number of daylight hours on a given day is fixed, and setting the clocks ahead 1 hour does nothing to increase the amount of daylight. A simple change of the labels on the hours of the day, calling 6 o'clock by the name 7 o'clock, nudges us all into waking up an hour earlier. Along with having more time to enjoy an evening softball game, we end up saving energy too. Historical note, the idea was first suggested by Benjamin Franklin during his tenure as an American delegate in Paris. A well-known skinflint, Franklin calculated that thousands of pounds of candle wax could be saved with his idea. However, the idea did not catch on until World War I. In many cases, markets provide self-control services and government is not needed at all. Companies can make a lot of money by strengthening planners in their battle with doers, often doing well by doing good. An interesting example is a distinctive financial services institution that used to be quite popular, the Christmas Savings Club. Here is how a Christmas club typically works. In November, around Thanksgiving, a customer opens an account at her local bank and commits herself to depositing a given amount, say $10, each week for the next year. Funds cannot be withdrawn until a year later, when the total amount is redeemed, just in time for the Christmas shopping season. The usual interest rate on these accounts is close to zero. Think about the Christmas club in economic terms. This is an account with no liquidity, you can't take your money out for a year, high transaction costs, you have to make deposits every week, and a near zero rate of return. It is an easy homework exercise in an economics class to prove that such an institution cannot exist. Yet for many years, Christmas clubs were widely used with billions of dollars in investments. If we realize that we are dealing with humans rather than econs, it is not hard to explain why the clubs flourished. Households lacking enough money for Christmas giving would resolve to solve the problem next year by joining a Christmas club. The inconvenience of making the deposits and the loss of money paid in interest would be small prices to pay in return for the assurance of having enough money to buy gifts. And think back to Ulysses, tying himself to the mast. The fact that money could not be withdrawn was a plus, not a minus. The absence of liquidity was precisely the point. Christmas clubs are in many ways an adult version of a child's piggy bank, designed to make it easier to put money in than to take money out. The fact that it is hard to withdraw money is entirely the point of the device. While Christmas clubs still exist, they have been made unnecessary for most households by the advent of credit cards. Since Christmas shopping can now be financed, households no longer find it necessary to save up in advance. This is not to say, of course, that the new regime is in all respects better. Saving at a 0% interest rate with no opportunity to withdraw the funds may seem dumb, and it is clearly worse than just depositing the money into an interest-bearing account, but earning a zero interest rate may well be preferable to paying 18% or more on credit card debt. The market battle between credit cards and Christmas clubs is a good illustration of a more general point, one to which we will return. Markets provide strong incentives for firms to cater to the demands of consumers, and firms will compete to meet those demands, whether or not those demands represent the wisest choices. One firm might devise a clever self-control device such as a Christmas club, but that firm cannot prevent another firm from offering to lend people money in anticipation of the receipt of those funds. Credit cards and Christmas clubs compete, and indeed both are offered by the same institutions, banks. While competition does drive down prices, it does not always lead to an outcome that is best for consumers. Even when we're on the way to making good choices, competitive markets find ways to get us to overcome our last shred of resistance to bad ones. At O'Hare Airport in Chicago, two food vendors compete across the aisle from each other. One sells fruit, yogurt, and other healthy foods. The other sells Cinnabuns, sinful cinnamon buns that have a whopping 730 calories and 24 grams of fat. Your planner may have set the course for the yogurt and fruit stand, but the Cinnabun outlet blasts the aromas from their ovens directly into the walkway in front of the store. Care to guess which of the two stores always has the longer line? Mental accounting. Alarm clocks and Christmas clubs are external devices people use to solve their self-control problems. Another way to approach these problems is to adopt internal control systems, otherwise known as mental accounting. Mental accounting is the system, sometimes implicit, that households use to evaluate, regulate, and process their home budget. Almost all of us use mental accounts, even if we're not aware that we're doing so. The concept is beautifully illustrated by an exchange between the actors Gene Hackman and Dustin Hoffman in one of those extra features offered on DVDs. Hackman and Hoffman were friends back in their starving artist days, and Hackman tells the story of visiting Hoffman's apartment and having his host ask him for a loan. Hackman agreed to the loan, but then they went into Hoffman's kitchen, where several mason jars were lined up on the counter, each containing money. One jar was labeled rent, another utilities, and so forth. Hackman asked why, if Hoffman had so much money in jars, he could possibly need a loan, whereupon Hoffman pointed to the food jar, which was empty. According to the economic theory, and simple logic, money is fungible, meaning that it doesn't come with labels. $20 in the rent jar can buy just as much food as the same amount in the food jar. But households adopt mental accounting schemes that violate fungibility for the same reasons that organizations do, to control spending. Most organizations have budgets for various activities, and anyone who has ever worked in such an organization has experienced the frustration of not being able to make an important purchase because the relevant account is already depleted. The fact that there is unspent money in another account is considered no more relevant than the money sitting in the rent jar on Dustin Hoffman's kitchen counter. At the household level, violations of fungibility are everywhere. One of the most creative examples of mental accounting was invented by a finance professor we know. At the beginning of each year, he designates a certain amount of money, say $2,000, as his intended gift to the United Way charity. Then if anything bad happens to him during the year, a parking ticket, for example, he mentally deducts the fine against the United Way gift. This provides him insurance against minor financial mishaps. You can also see mental accounting in action at the casino. Watch a gambler who is lucky enough to win some money early in the evening. You might see him take the money he has won and put it into one pocket, and put the money he brought with him to gamble that evening, yet another mental account, into a different pocket. Gamblers even have a term for this. The money that has recently been won is called house money, because in gambling parlance, the casino is referred to as the house. Betting some of the money that you have just won is referred to as gambling with the house's money, as if it were, somehow, different from some other kind of money. Experimental evidence reveals that people are more willing to gamble with money that they consider house money. This same mentality affects people who never gamble. When investments pay off, people are willing to take big chances with their winnings. For example, mental accounting contributed to the large increase in stock prices in the 1990s, as many people took on more and more risk with the justification that they were playing only with their gains from the past few years. Similarly, people are far more likely to splurge impulsively on a big luxury purchase when they receive an unexpected windfall than with savings that they have accumulated over time, even if those savings are fully available to be spent. Mental accounting matters precisely because the accounts are treated as non-fungible. True, the mason jars used by Dustin Hoffman and his parents' generation have largely disappeared. But many households continue to designate accounts for various uses, children's education, vacations, retirement, and so forth. In many cases, these are literally different accounts as opposed to entries in a ledger. The sanctity of these accounts can lead to seemingly bizarre behavior, such as simultaneously borrowing and lending at very different rates. David Gross and Nick Sueles, 2002, found that the typical household in their sample had more than $5,000 in liquid assets, typically in savings accounts earning less than 5% a year, and nearly $3,000 in credit card balances, carrying a typical interest rate of 18% or more. Using the money from the savings account to pay off the credit card debt amounts to what economists call an arbitrage opportunity, buying low and selling high, but the vast majority of households fail to take advantage. Just as with Christmas clubs, though, this behavior might not be as stupid as it looks. Many of these households have borrowed up to the limits that their credit cards set. They may realize that if they paid off the credit card debt from the savings account, they would soon run up the cards to their limits once again. And the credit card companies, fully aware of this, are often more than willing to extend more credit to those who have reached the limit, as long as they aren't yet falling behind on interest payments. Keeping the money in the separate accounts is thus another costly self-control strategy, just like the Christmas club. Of course, many people do not suffer from an inability to save. Some people actually have trouble spending. If their problem is extreme, we call such people misers. But even regular folks can find that they don't give themselves enough treats. We have a friend named Dennis who has adopted a clever mental accounting strategy to deal with this problem. When Dennis turned 65, he started collecting Social Security payments, although both he and his wife continued to work full-time. Since he has been a good saver over the years, in part because his employer has a mandatory and generous retirement plan, Dennis wanted to be sure he would do the things he enjoys, especially trips to Paris with lots of eating, now while he is still healthy, and not be put off by the expense. So he opened a special savings account for his Social Security checks and has designated the money in this account as a fun account. A fancy new bike or a case of good wine would be acceptable purchases from this account, but a repair to the roof would certainly not. For each of us, using mental accounts can be extremely valuable. They make life both more fun and more secure. Many of us could benefit from a near-sacrosanct rainy day account and from a freely available entertainment and fun account. Understanding mental accounts would also improve public policy. As we shall see, if we want to encourage savings, it will be important to direct the increased savings into a mental or real account where spending it will not be too big a temptation. Chapter 3: Following the Herd. The Reverend Jim Jones was the founder and leader of the People's Temple. In 1978, Jones, facing charges of tax evasion, moved most of his 1,000 followers from San Francisco to a small settlement in Guyana, which he named Jonestown. Facing a federal investigation for reported acts of child abuse and torture, Jones decided that his followers should poison their children and then themselves. They prepared vats of poison. A few people resisted. A few others shouted out their protest, but they were silenced. Following Jones's orders and the social pressures imposed by one another, mothers and fathers duly poisoned their children. Then they poisoned themselves. Their bodies were found arm in arm, lying together. Econs, and some economists we know, are pretty unsociable creatures. They communicate with others if they can gain something from the encounter. They care about their reputations, and they will learn from others if actual information can be obtained. But econs are not followers of fashion. Their hemlines would not go up and down except for practical reasons, and ties, if they existed at all in a world of econs, would not grow narrower and wider simply as a matter of style. By the way, ties were originally used as napkins. They actually had a function. Humans, on the other hand, are frequently nudged by other humans. Sometimes massive social changes in markets and politics alike start with a small social nudge. Humans are not exactly lemmings, but they are easily influenced by the statements and deeds of others. Again, by the way, lemmings do not really commit mass suicide by following one another into the ocean. Our widely shared and somewhat defamatory beliefs about lemmings are based on an all-too-human urban legend. That is, people believe this because they are following other people. By contrast, the tale of mass suicide at Jonestown is no legend. If you see a movie scene in which people are smiling, you are more likely to smile yourself, whether or not the movie is funny. Yawns are contagious too. Conventional wisdom has it that if two people live together for a long time, they start to look like each other. This bit of folk wisdom turns out to be true. For the curious, they grow to look alike partly because of nutrition, shared diets and eating habits, but much of the effect is simple imitation of facial expressions. In fact, couples who end up looking alike also tend to be happier. In this chapter, we try to understand how and why social influences work. An understanding of those influences is important in our context for two reasons. First, most people learn from others. This is usually good, of course. Learning from others is how individuals and societies develop. But many of our biggest misconceptions also come from others. When social influences have caused people to have false or biased beliefs, then some nudging may help. The second reason why this topic is important for our purposes is that one of the most effective ways to nudge, for good or evil, is via social influence. In Jonestown, that influence was so strong that an entire population committed suicide. But social influences have also created miracles, large and small. In many cities, including ours, dog owners now carry plastic bags when they walk their dogs, and strolling through the park has become much more pleasant as a result. This has happened even though the risk of being fined for unclean dog walking is essentially zero. Choice architects need to know how to encourage other socially beneficial behavior, and also how to discourage events like the one that occurred in Jonestown. Social influences come in two basic categories. The first involves information. If many people do something or think something, their actions and their thoughts convey information about what might be best for you to do or think. The second involves peer pressure. If you care about what other people think about you, perhaps in the mistaken belief that they are paying some attention to what you are doing, see below, then you might go along with the crowd to avoid their wrath or curry their favor. For a quick glance at the power of social nudges, consider just a few research findings. 1. Teenage girls who see that other teenagers are having children are more likely to become pregnant themselves. 2. Obesity is contagious. If your best friends get fat, your risk of gaining weight goes up. 3. Broadcasters mimic one another, producing otherwise inexplicable fads in programming. Think reality television, American Idol and its siblings, game shows that come and go, the rise and fall and rise of science fiction, and so forth. 4. The academic effort of college students is influenced by their peers, so much so that the random assignments of first-year students to dormitories or roommates can have big consequences for their grades and hence on their future prospects. Maybe parents should worry less about which college their kids go to and more about which roommate they get. 5. Federal judges on 3-judge panels are affected by the votes of their colleagues. The typical Republican appointee shows pretty liberal voting patterns when sitting with 2 Democratic appointees, and the typical Democratic appointee shows pretty conservative voting patterns when sitting with 2 Republican appointees. Both sets of appointees show far more moderate voting patterns when they are sitting with at least 1 judge appointed by a president of the opposing political party. The bottom line is that humans are easily nudged by other humans. Why? One reason is that we like to conform. Doing what others do. Imagine that you find yourself in a group of 6 people engaged in a test of visual perception. You are given a ridiculously simple task. You are supposed to match a particular line, shown on a large white card, to the one of 3 comparison lines projected onto a screen that is identical to it in length. In the first 3 rounds of this test, everything proceeds smoothly and easily. People make their matches aloud in sequence, and everyone agrees with everyone else. But on the fourth round, something odd happens. The five other people in the group announce their matches before you, and everyone makes an obvious error. It is now time for you to make your announcement. What will you do? If you are like most people, you think it is easy to predict your behavior in this task. You will say exactly what you think. You'll call it as you see it. You are independent-minded, and so you will tell the truth. But if you are a human, and you really participated in the experiment, you might well follow those who preceded you and say what they say, thus defying the evidence of your own senses. In the 1950s, Solomon Asch, 1995, a brilliant social psychologist, conducted a series of experiments in just this vein. When asked to decide on their own, without seeing judgment from others, people almost never erred, since the test was easy. But when everyone else gave an incorrect answer, people erred more than one-third of the time. Indeed, in a series of 12 questions, nearly three-quarters of the people went along with the group at least once, defying the evidence of their own senses. Notice that in Ash's experiment, people were responding to the decisions of strangers, whom they would probably never see again. They had no particular reason to want those strangers to like them. Ash's findings seemed to capture something universal about humanity. Conformity experiments have been replicated and extended in more than 130 experiments from 17 countries, including Zaire, Germany, France, Japan, Norway, Lebanon, and Kuwait, Sunstein, 2003. The overall pattern of errors, with people conforming between 20% and 40% of the time, does not show huge differences across nations. And though 20% to 40% of the time might not seem large, remember that this task was very simple. It is almost as if people can be nudged into identifying a picture of a dog as a cat as long as other people before them have done so. Why exactly do people sometimes ignore the evidence of their own senses? We have already sketched the two answers. The first involves the information conveyed by people's answers. The second involves peer pressure and the desire not to face the disapproval of the group. In Ash's own studies, several of the conformists said, in private interviews, that their initial perceptions must have been wrong. If everyone in the room accepts a certain proposition or sees things in a certain way, you might conclude that they are probably right. Remarkably, recent brain imaging work has suggested that when people conform in Ash-like settings, they actually see the situation as everyone else does. On the other hand, social scientists generally find less conformity in the same basic circumstances as Ash's experiments when people are asked to give anonymous answers. People become more likely to conform when they know that other people will see what they have to say. Sometimes people will go along with the group even when they think, or know, that everyone else has blundered. Unanimous groups are able to provide the strongest nudges, even when the question is an easy one and people ought to know that everyone else is wrong. Ash's experiments involved evaluations with pretty obvious answers. Most of the time, it isn't hard to assess the length of lines. What if the task is made a bit more difficult? The question is especially important for our purposes because we are particularly interested in how people are influenced, or can be influenced, in dealing with problems that are both hard and unfamiliar. Some key studies were undertaken in the 1930s by the psychologist Muzaffer Sharif, 1937. In Sharif's experiment, people were placed in a dark room and a small pinpoint of light was positioned at some distance in front of them. The light was actually stationary, but because of a perceptual illusion caused by the autokinetic effect, it appeared to move. On each of several trials, Sharif asked people to estimate the distance that the light had moved. When polled individually, subjects did not agree with one another, and their answers varied significantly from one trial to another. This is not surprising, because the light did not move, any judgment about distance was a stab in the literal dark. But Sharif found big conformity effects when people were asked to act in small groups and to make their estimates in public. Here, the individual judgments converged in a group norm, establishing the consensus distance, quickly developed. Over time, the norm remained stable within particular groups, thus leading to a situation in which different groups made, and were strongly committed to, quite different judgments. There is an important clue here about how seemingly similar groups, cities, and even nations can converge on very different beliefs and actions simply because of modest and even arbitrary variations in starting points. Sharif also tried a nudge. In some experiments, he added a confederate, his own ally, unbeknownst to the people in the study. When he did that, something else happened. If the Confederate spoke confidently and firmly, his judgment had a strong influence on the group's assessment. If the Confederate's estimate was much higher than those initially made by the others, the group's judgment would be inflated. If the Confederate's estimate was very low, the group's estimate would fall. A little nudge, if it was expressed confidently, can have major consequences for the group's conclusion. The clear lesson here is that consistent and unwavering people in the private or public sector can move groups and practices in their preferred direction. More remarkable still, the group's judgments became thoroughly internalized so that people would adhere to them even when reporting on their own, indeed even a year later, and even when participating in new groups whose members offered different judgments. Significantly, the initial judgments were also found to have effects across generations. Even when enough fresh subjects were introduced and others retired so that all the participants were new to the situation, the original group judgment tended to stick, although the person who was originally responsible for it had been long gone. In a series of experiments, people using Sharif's basic method have shown that an arbitrary tradition, in the form of some judgment about the distance, can become entrenched over time, so that many people follow it notwithstanding its original arbitrariness. We can see here why many groups fall prey to what is known as collective conservatism, the tendency of groups to stick to established patterns even as new ones arise. Once a practice, like wearing ties, has become established, it is likely to be perpetuated even if there is no particular basis for it. Sometimes a tradition can last for a long time and receive support or at least acquiescence from large numbers of people, even though it was originally the product of a small nudge from a few people or perhaps even one. Of course, a group will shift if it can be shown that the practice is causing serious problems. But if there is uncertainty on that question, people might well continue doing what they have always done. An important problem here is pluralistic ignorance, that is, ignorance on the part of all or most about what other people think. We may follow a practice or a tradition not because we like it or even think it's defensible, but merely because we think that most other people like it. Many social practices persist for this reason, and a small shock or nudge can dislodge them. A dramatic example is communism in the former Soviet bloc, which lasted in part because people were unaware how many people despised the regime. Dramatic but less world historical changes, rejecting long-standing practices, can often be produced by a nudge that starts a kind of bandwagon effect. Additional experiments growing out of Ash's basic method find large conformity effects for judgments of many different kinds. Consider the following finding. People were asked, "Which one of the following do you feel is the most important problem facing our country today?" 5 alternatives were offered: economic recession, educational facilities, subversive activities, mental health, and crime and corruption. Asked privately, a mere 12% chose subversive activities. But when exposed to an apparent group consensus, unanimously selecting that option, 48% of people made the same choice. In a similar finding, people were asked to consider this statement: free speech being a privilege rather than a right, it is proper for a society to suspend free speech when it feels threatened. Asked this question individually, only 19% of the control group agreed. But confronted with the shared opinion of only 4 others, 58% of people agreed. These results are closely connected with one of Ash's underlying interests, which was to understand how Nazism had been possible. Ash believed that conformity could produce a very persistent nudge, ultimately generating behavior, such as the events in Jonestown, that might seem unthinkable. Whether or not Ash's work provides an adequate account of the rise of fascism, or even the events in Jonestown, there is no question that social pressures nudge people to accept some pretty odd conclusions, and those conclusions might well affect their behavior. An obvious question is whether choice architects can exploit this fact to move people in better directions. Suppose, for example, that a city is trying to encourage people to exercise more so as to improve their health. If many people are exercising, the city might be able to produce significant changes simply by mentioning that fact. A few influential people, offering strong signals about appropriate behavior, can have a similar effect. Consider Texas's imaginative and stunningly successful effort to reduce littering on its highways. Texas officials were enormously frustrated by the failure of their well-funded and highly publicized advertising campaigns, which attempted to convince people that it was their civic duty to stop littering. Many of the litterers were men between the ages of 18 and 24, who were not exactly impressed by the idea that a bureaucratic elite wanted them to change their behavior. Public officials decided that they needed a tough-talking slogan that would also address the unique spirit of Texas pride.